Greetings, listeners and friends of the RIOTC. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia Incorporated, saying welcome to the broadcast for October 2019. I am Bruce, VK3UV, and on behalf of the RIOTC President and Committee, I would like to thank all of our volunteers who have helped with the relaying of this broadcast, and I especially thank the committee and members of the EMDRC for permission to use VK3REC for the relay of our monthly broadcasts in the Melbourne area. This broadcast is relayed on a number of frequencies on the first Monday of the month, except for January. The transmissions emanate from many different sources, and the actual times and frequencies may be found on our website www.raotc.org.au. Also, at 8:30pm local time, this broadcast is repeated on 80 metres from Melbourne, and also by Tony VK7AX via a video stream. Please refer to our website for the streaming details. And I would like to remind listeners that we are adding additional relays to our broadcast, mainly in VK3, on 40 metres at 1600 hours local, on 7.146 MHz, and on the 2-metre FM repeater, VK3REC, at 8pm. This audio file will be uploaded to our website on the day prior to the live-to-air broadcasts, so that listeners may have the opportunity to hear it at a time more suitable to themselves. Club news. This month we have two items of club news: a new member, and regretfully, the passing of a member. We'd like to welcome John Nichols, VK3YKB, who became a full new RAATC member number 1772 on the 19th of September 2019. And now it's my sad duty to report that we have lost Maurie O'Keefe, VK3KO, RAOTC life member number 1336. He became a silent key at the age of 94. Let us pause for a few moments in memory of our departed colleague. Thank you. Here is a news item from the National Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, in respect of Cycle 25. And it was submitted to us again by John Cheeseman, VK3XM. Thank you, John. Cycle 25 predicted to be similar to Cycle 24. Scientists predicting the Sun's activity for Solar Cycle 25 say it's likely to be much like that of current Cycle 24, which is declining and predicted to bottom out in 2019 or 2020. Solar Cycle 25 prediction panel experts said Solar Cycle 25 may be off to a slow start, but is anticipated to peak between 2023 and 2026, with a sunspot range of 95 to 130. This is well below the typical average of 140 to 220 sunspots per solar cycle. The panel expressed high confidence that the coming cycle would break the trend of weakening solar activity seen over the past four cycles. The Solar Cycle Prediction Panel forecasts the number of sunspots expected for solar maximum, along with the timing of the peak and minimum solar activity levels for the cycle. We expect Solar Cycle 25 to be very similar to Cycle 24, another fairly weak cycle preceded by a long, deep minimum, said Solar Panel co-chair Lisa Upton, a solar physicist with the Space Systems Research Corporation. The expectation that Cycle 25 will be comparable in size to Cycle 24 means that the steady decline in solar cycle amplitude seen from cycles 21 to 24 has come to an end, and that there is no indication that we are currently approaching a Maunder-type minimum in solar activity. The solar cycle prediction gives a rough idea of the frequency of space weather storms of all types, from radio blackouts to geomagnetic storms and solar radiation storms. In addition to its effect on amateur radio signal propagation, space weather can affect power grids, critical military, airline and shipping communication, satellites and GPS signals, and can even threaten astronauts through exposure to harmful radiation. Solar cycle 24 reached its maximum in April 2014, with a peak average of 82. The Sun's northern hemisphere led the sunspot cycle, peaking more than 2 years ahead of the southern hemisphere sunspot peak. Given that the Sun takes 11 years to complete one solar cycle, this is only the fourth time that US scientists have issued a solar cycle prediction. The first panel convened in 1989 for cycle 22. For solar cycle 25, the panel hopes for the first time to predict the presence, amplitude and timing of any differences between the northern and southern hemispheres of the Sun, known as hemispheric asymmetry. Later this year, the panel will release an official sunspot number curve showing the predicted number of sunspots during the given year and any expected asymmetry. The panel will also look into the possibility of providing a solar flare probability forecast. While we are not predicting a particular active solar 25, violent eruptions from the Sun can occur at any time, said Doug Biesecker, panel co-chair and solar physicist at the NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Centre. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia, Incorporated. Here is an article submitted to us by a committee member, John Cheeseman, VK3XM, and it is entitled, Ending the Great Radio Silence After the Great War. Practical wireless was still in its infancy at the turn of the 20th century, and unregulated experimentation rampant. Chaos reigned on the airwaves. Given the technology of the day, spark gap transmitters that emitted very, very broad signals, interference was a problem. As Al Brogdon, W1AB, explains in The World War I Shutdown, which was published in the September 2019 issue of QST, hams, passenger ships and the US Navy were the main users of wireless, and the Navy went to Congress in an unsuccessful effort to wrest control over radio and, effectively, abolish ham radio in the United States. Radio amateurs opposing the bill had an ally in the Marconi Company. When the US in 1917 joined the European conflict that became World War I, the federal government ordered hams to disassemble their stations, lower their antennas, and not use transmitters or receivers. Many hams who joined the military took their own radio gear along because, as Brogdon explains, the military didn't have enough radio equipment. The end of the war did not mean the resumption of amateur radio. Hams were allowed to use their receivers again, but not transmit. The Navy was still in charge of all US radio communications, and another bill introduced in Congress proposed handing over ongoing control of all radio to the Navy. Publication of QST also ceased during the war, and many hams had let their ARRL membership lapse for the duration. ARRL officers and key members dug into their own wallets to thwart the bill, mailing a little blue card to members, urging them to ask their congressional representatives to oppose the Navy proposal. ARRL President Hiram Percy Maximum went to Washington to speak against the bill, which died in committee. It was not until 1919, amid another Navy effort to gain control over radio that was stalled by opposition from hams and others, that the transmitting ban was lifted by an act of Congress. As Brogdon explains, Maxim went to Washington again and found a sympathetic ear in Massachusetts Congressman William Green, who ultimately introduced the successful House Joint Resolution 217, which asked the Navy to remove the restrictions on the use and operation of amateur radio stations throughout the United States. Hams were back on the air by the fall of 1919, 100 years ago. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. I now present the first of two recordings by Clive, VK6CSW. They are about Captain Henry Joseph Round, who was an English engineer and one of the early pioneers of radio. He was the first to report observation of electroluminescence from a solid-state diode, leading to the discovery of the light-emitting diode. He was a personal assistant to Guglielmo Marconi. Now here is Clive, VK6CSW, to present part one.
Henry Joseph Round, unrecognized electronics pioneer. Nearly 50 years ago, on the 31st of May 1916, the Battle of Jutland was fought. This encounter has passed into the history books, not only because of its profound influence on the outcome of the Great War, but also on account of its epic scale and ferocity. But Jutland is historic in another respect, for it was the first sea battle in which the use of electronics played a dominant part. If there had been no electronics, there would have been no Battle of Jutland. The secret of how this came about was closely guarded until the end of the war. Then, in 1920, Admiral Sir Henry Jackson, who had been First Sea Lord in 1916, disclosed that the man primarily responsible for bringing the event to pass was a certain Captain H.J. Round. It happened in this manner. For the first 2 years of the war, the British Navy had failed to bring the German fleet to decisive battle because of a lag in communications. The Germans had made brief forays into the North Sea, but always by the time the Admiralty had learned about one of these and the Grand Fleet had put out to intercept, the enemy was again snug in harbour. But, unknown to the Germans, a network of sensitive direction-finding stations had been erected at various sites in the British Isles, and these were not only proving their value in tracking Zeppelin raids and submarine movements, but also for establishing the positions of German surface warships by taking bearings on their wireless telegraphy transmissions. At that time, the German Navy, when in home waters, used low-power transmission freely, confident that the signals could not be picked up in Britain. But thanks to Round's development of amplifiers of unprecedented sensitivity, this was a false premise. Then, on the 30th of May 1916, the DF stations reported that a German warship lying at Wilhelmshaven, 300 miles away, was unusually prolific with her wireless signals. That same afternoon it was further noted by the stations that the vessel had left Wilhelmshaven and was now lying in the River Yarder, about 7 miles away from her original station, shown by a change in bearing of less than 1.5 degree. The Admiralty reasoned from this information that she was about to put to sea and that the incessant chatter of her wireless telegraphy had constituted sailing orders to other warships. It was the opportunity the naval authorities had been looking for, the chance to get into a favourable position in time to strike. The Grand Fleet was ordered to put to sea with all haste and make for the German Bight, and on the following day the German Navy was brought to battle. Electronics had made this possible. The direction-finding equipment, which used soft sea valves and a modified Bellini-Tosi directional system, had been developed by H.J. Round of the Marconi Company at Broomfield, Chelmsford, just before the war. It was not long before Round's work came to the notice of the War Office, and on the outbreak of hostilities he was seconded to intelligence and ordered to provide an initial 2 stations for service in France. This was speedily done, and, following the success of these, a network covering the entire Western Front evolved. Further stations in Britain were also commissioned, Round being recalled from France to be responsible for these. Naval vessels were also fitted with DF equipment. One of Round's inventions, in connection with its use on ships, was a quadrantal error-correcting device. But these are only wartime incidents in a career studied with no fewer than 117 patent applications, which included his British patent for the use of the thermionic valve as a generator of continuous wave oscillations, and those on the screen grid and RF pentode valves, which revolutionized receiver design in the mid-1920s. Henry Joseph Round was born on the 2nd of June 1881 at King's Winford, Staffordshire. His early education took place at Cheltenham, but later he studied at the Royal College of Science, gaining first-class honours. In 1902 he joined the Marconi Company and was sent to America, where, he recalls, his office junior was a youngster by the name of David Sarnoff, now chairman of the Radio Corporation of America and internationally famous. RCA stemmed from the American Marconi Company. His next assignment was to the Marconi Training School in Babylon, Long Island, New York, where wireless operators were trained. But Round's inventive spirit was already quickening, and whenever possible he enlivened his official duties and his spare time with investigations into some of the problems of wireless reception and transmission. At this time, 1903-104, he carried out experimental work on dust cores for tuning inductances and also conducted various transmission and reception tests over land and sea using various frequencies. He also experimented with directional frame antennas and combined these with vertical antennas to give cardioid polar diagrams. None of these extramural activities produced any positive contribution in the form of patents, but the various areas of experience were all to become useful to him later on. It's also of interest to note that the lossy effect, light produced by applying DC to certain semiconductors, which officially dates from 1923, should properly be known as the Round effect, for a letter in Electrical World on the 9th of February 1907, signed by H.J. Round, gives notice of this discovery that silicon carbide could act as a generator of light when a potential was applied across it. This, of course, was the beginning of the light-emitting diode. Another subject which intrigued Round at this time was the possibility of devising a practical wireless telephone. Unfortunately, his aspirations were jeopardized because he got the sack, not because of any shortcoming, but because the American Marconi Company was now in low water financially and economy was the watchword. Round went to see Thomas Edison, the great American inventor, but Edison was unable to offer him more than $12 a week. Eventually, the young engineer found employment in the New York telephone laboratories and received permission to use nearby Marconi premises for private experimental work. There he produced an arc wireless telephone, working on it at night in a room with the temperature often below freezing point and only rats for company. The signal radiation from the equipment was satisfactory, but the quality was very poor. Shortly afterwards, the Marconi company found itself in a position to reinstate him, and Round was sent back to England. Here he continued his wireless telephony experiments and demonstrated the apparatus to Marconi over a distance of 5 miles. He became a personal assistant to Marconi, and this involved him in a great diversity of experimental and practical work. One equipment which he developed at this time, 1908, was a very useful commercial wave meter. 1910-11 found him at the Clifton Transmitting Station in Ireland, the high-power station which formed the European terminal of the transatlantic wireless circuit, investigating a mysterious loss of transmitting power. Round discovered that the transmission was taking place on two discrete wavelengths. He redesigned the circuits, lengthened the wavelength, and restored the service with much improved power. During this period, he also spent considerable time investigating the possibility of reducing the effect of natural static interference and patented a balanced crystal circuit for this purpose.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
Further assignments took him with Marconi to Canada, Italy, and South America. On the South American trip, he received signals from Clifton at a range of 4,000 miles in daylight and 6,000 miles after dark. In 1912, Round was delegated to carry out a hazardous job in South America. The Marconi Company had installed two stations for the Madeira to Mamor Railway in Brazil, one at Manaus and the other at Porto Velho, both on the upper reaches of the Amazon. The presence of an unprecedented degree of static interference and heavy signal attenuation over the jungle path had made the company unable to meet its contract guarantee of a traffic rate of 5,000 words per day. The solution was doubly serious, as Marconi was in the throes of another financial crisis and could not afford to lose the contract money. Furthermore, other large-scale business depended on the successful operation of the railway circuit. Round was in charge of the team sent out to investigate, having been given a free hand to do whatever was necessary. This was where his early experimental work on transmission by day and night on various frequencies was to stand him in good stead. For it must be remembered that in those days, the effective wavelength on day and night ranges, in other words, the behaviour of the ionosphere, was not widely known, much less understood. Round's first act was to substitute night working for daylight, a procedure which was so successful that a month's arrears of traffic were cleared in one night. From this, he realised that the wavelength being used, 2,000 metres, was too short for effective daylight operation over the path, and accordingly rewound the inductances and adjusted the antennas at both stations for use on longer wavelengths. This done, it was found that signals were readable in daylight between the hours of 6 a.m. and noon, using only 5 kilowatts, but that any attempt to raise the power to the full 50 kilowatts resulted in breakdown of the Leyden jar capacitors. This was near disaster, situated as they were, thousands of miles up the Amazon, in the middle of a jungle, with no suitable spares to hand. Round was not beaten. He organised a team of 30 Brazilians, and under his direction they removed the capacitor elements one by one, keeping the service going. The tinfoil was cleaned with boiling oil, and then built up around the edges with copper mosquito netting, the only suitable material available. The operation, first carried out at Porto Velho, took a month to complete, after which the installation at Manaus was given similar treatment. The outcome was completely successful, now operating on 2,000 metres by night and 4,000 metres by day. The station worked admirably at 50 kilowatts, with continuous communication over the densely forested path. The contract guarantees were more than covered, and the customer highly appreciative. This is believed to be the first time that deliberate use was made of different wavelengths for day and night communication. By this time, 1912, Round had proved himself as an engineer of resource and unusual ability, but so far with only 5 patents to his credit. The main flower of his inventive genius, including his tremendous contribution to valve technology, was yet to come.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. We now come to this month's joke. A man walks into a bar very down on himself. As he walks up to the bartender asks, "What's the matter?" The man replies, "Well, I've got these 2 horses and, well, I can't tell them apart. I don't know if I'm mixing up riding times or even feeding them the right foods." The bartender, feeling sorry for the guy, tries to think of something he can do. He says, "Why don't you try shaving the tail of one of the horses?" The man stops crying and says, "That sounds like a good idea. I think I'll try it." A few months later, he comes back to the bar in a worse condition than he was before. "What's the matter now?" the bartender asks. The man, in no condition to be in public, answers, "I shaved the tail of one of the horses, but it grew back, and now I can't tell them apart again." The bartender, now wanting him to just shut up or leave, says, "For crying out loud, just measure the stupid horses. Perhaps one is slightly taller than the other one." The man cannot believe what the bartender was said, and storms out of the bar. The next day, the man comes running back into the bar as if he'd just won the lottery. "It worked, it worked," he exclaims. "I measured the horses, and the black one is 2 centimetres taller than the white one." Thank you for listening. This now concludes our session for this month. All being well, we shall be back with you on Monday, 4th of November, 2019. Until then, keep operating your equipment, and if you think a band is dead, give a few CQs. You never know who is out there listening until you press that push-to-talk button. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying 73, and listing now for any check-ins and callbacks.